Morning. With this class, we will be inaugurating our next section in the worldview section of our class. We've talked over the past few weeks about the philosophical foundations, kind of, for the Christian worldview and for other worldviews. This week, we'll be discussing the arts, Christian view of the arts. Next week, hopefully finishing that up and talking about mathematics. After that, Scott will be giving us a lecture on culture, Christian view of culture, and then we'll have a lecture on education, and Dana will give us, we'll talk about science, Christian view of science. Scott will be talking about the images of spiritual things that God has placed throughout his creation, and then Jack Sawyer will be bringing us government and politics. So this is the section of the class that I most looked forward to when agreeing to do it. Certainly the arts are very important to humanity, and to me as well, as a musician, and just, I guess, as a human being, arts, it's, in today's culture, often underappreciated and misunderstood. So hopefully, in today's class, we'll have a better understanding of what the purpose of the arts is, as well as how better to understand and to appreciate and to enjoy the arts. We'll be starting the book, the frame book, in December, so no worries if you can't get it in the next couple of weeks. Hopefully, they are on order. Hopefully, they'll be coming in pretty soon. So, on to the class. First of all, this book here is pretty much the foundation for the class that the structure of the class. This is by Jean Edward Veith, called The State of the Arts. Excellent book. I stole a lot of the structure from him, so just up front, I'm very appreciative to Mr. Veith and also and all the work that he's done. So, what is art? I'm not going to claim to actually have a really complete, perfect definition for art, but I hope to cover certain aspects of it, certain ways of looking at it. First of all, I would say that art is work. What do I mean by that? It's hard to look at art as work when today's culture says that the artist is somehow above the common man. The artist has sensibilities that are more advanced and harder to understand. And if you deign to try to appreciate the arts, somehow you have to be also higher than the common man. This is a very recent phenomenon. Over thousands of years, art was seen as part of everyday life. When the craftsman was making a bowl, some craftsmen would make a bowl that had a concave section that you could put stuff in. Other ones would decorate the outside, decorate the inside, paint it different ways, add different patterns on the outside. And they weren't saying to themselves, I'm going to be higher than my neighbor. I'm going to somehow be more intellectually superior to my neighbor. I'm going to do art. They were just doing what they normally did, but in a more excellent way. The reason we have the term artisan, nowadays, it's considered a term for someone who's very highly skilled in his craft. And that's true, but the artisan over many years has just been someone who is making things, everyday things, bowls, quilts, baskets. There is a book called The Art of Computer Programming. There's also a book called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Why do they talk about art? It's because art, that's a carryover from the older, more traditional, what I would say, more correct understanding of what art is. Art is not something that is over there, and some people appreciate it, and those people somehow are smarter than everybody else. Even God's creation, which we would consider the first art, the prototypical art, is connected with the idea of God's hands, God's fingers. In Psalm 8, talks about, when I consider the heavens, the work of your fingers. It's very much an understanding of art that has to do with work. Adam, when when he was made, was told to cultivate and keep the garden before the fall. He didn't have to be, he didn't have to work to provide the basic level of food that was provided for him. It was not merely labor. He was not toiling. His work was art. He was told to keep the garden, and as an unfallen human being, he would do it well to God's glory without distraction. Mr. Veith says, creativity is at the essence of the human capacity to work, to be productive, and to serve society. And if we view our work as art, if we view our calling as mothers, as computer programmers, as pharmaceutical salesmen, as testers, as everything that God has called us to be, if we view that as art, we will first of all have the potential to rediscover the satisfactions. I'm using Mr. Veith's words. Rediscover the satisfactions of doing what God has called us to do. God has called us to do things unto His glory, and He's given us the ability to do it. And if we view it as art, if we view it as something that can be done well, then we'll be more likely to be satisfied by it. We will be able to develop the artist's obsession with excellence. I enjoy that thought. When I'm sitting in front of a computer at work, there's a lot of dull things that I have to do. But if I do them well, it helps people. If I do them well, I can look back on it and consider that I have done what at my job, as if God was sitting next to me and looking at what I was doing directly. So art is work, and I think this is probably one of the most fundamental things that I would like personally to see art as, but also everybody in this classroom. I think this is probably one of the most fundamental aspects of looking at art that we need to improve in, I think. Secondly, art is self-expression, projecting oneself and one's worldview into the environment around you. This can be in terms of creating a painting that conveys a certain thought. It's like Picasso's Guernica, talking about the horrors of war. It can be all the way down to, I think it's worth living in a beautiful environment, so I'm going to decorate my house. I think it's good to have buildings that are beautiful, so I'm going to design a beautiful building rather than simply a functional building. If you look back at communist-era Russia, it was the most remarkable thing about it, aesthetically, was that it was gray. Gray and square. There was nothing beautiful about it. In throwing out religion, self-consciously, they threw out beauty. Art is sub-creation, and this is a word that J.R.R. Tolkien, the author of The Lord of the Rings, used to describe the act of imitating God in creating something. Aristotle and Plato called it mimesis, imitation. It is not creation in the true sense, because only God can create. Creation is out of nothing. Everything else is taking what's already there and forming it in a new way. And we'll discuss this more later. That is a very cursory, superficial description of what art is. I think probably the best way to understand what art is really to immerse yourself in it, to read lots of poetry, to look at art, to think about surrounding yourself with beautiful things for the purpose of being better able to appreciate God's creation, and also to look forward to the coming new heavens and the new earth, where C.S. Lewis called our current age shadows of the future age to come. If we think in terms of types and shadows, or types and anti-types, our current world is sort of can be thought of as a shadow of the type of the new heavens and the new earth. So what we see is very real to us, but what we will see is more real. That was C.S. Lewis's notion he called them the shadow lands, is where we live now. So, next I'd like to discuss the scope of the arts. After that, understanding art, some ways that we can understand art better. And also, I'd like to discuss some problems with contemporary art, and this is probably the one that we can best relate to. But first of all, the scope of the arts. And I'd like to cover the arts in three different categories. One is the functional art, second is decorative art, and the third is fine arts. Of course, these are not very clean buckets that we can place a piece of art in or a particular thing that we're looking at. We can't say, okay, that's decorative, okay, that one's functional, because the line, it's sort of a continuum, but if you look at the fundamental desire of the artist, then that is kind of how we're dividing it. Functional art was meant to be used for something, primarily. But, and it can be done well and it can be done poorly, so any building would be considered functional art. Now, if the person had zero aesthetic sensibilities, it's a box because it's the most efficient form for a building, and it has two floors and everything is purely efficient, there's nothing aesthetically pleasing about it, it's art, but it's not good art, right? Architecture is a good example of functional art. Bowls, pottery, crafts. Now, those are not necessarily so functional now because it's cheaper to go to Walmart and get some Corelware, but if we look in the past, people were making their everyday objects beautiful. They were making vases and urns and that kind of thing. Nowadays, we have... you'll hear a lot of computer references because that's what I do every day. Engineering and well-written code, well-written programming language. If you look at it, people speak in terms of elegant solutions to problems. People use aesthetic language to describe what they've done. And it's fully appropriate because this is all functional art. What I do every day, I look at it and ultimately it boils down to ones and zeros in a certain order. But stepping back from it, the interface between my mind and my creativity and the computer is an occasion for art, for functional art. Decorative art. It's hard to prove philosophically, but this is one of the major reasons why Christianity accounts for reality better than any other worldview. The human mind, the human heart, has this urge to make things pretty. To look around and say, oh, that's too bare, I'm going to put a picture up. Or, you know, oh, this place would look nice if I took this piece of cloth and slung it around. That adds nothing functionally to your life. But really, it does make your life better. You're more... Read this book. Hidden Art of Homemaking. It's an excellent book on... I know a lot of ladies in our church have read this book, but it's a very good book for just talking about surrounding yourself with beautiful things and surrounding yourself with beauty. Pardon?
Have you read that book?
I've read parts of it. I plan to read more of it.
I just wondered, Carolyn, I remember you taking your description of taking cloth and
slinging
it around.
I know, I was trying to speak in those terms because if you're looking from a purely modernistic functional perspective and throwing out beauty altogether, then that's what it is, right? You know, you put some colors on the wall, you know, but really they have a profound impact and non-Christian worldviews can't really account for that. Now, thankfully, that doesn't mean that non-Christian worldviews say, okay, well then I must be ugly. There are a few worldviews that say that, but most people who are living inconsistent with their anti-God perspective are not going to throw out beauty because beauty is a remnant of the image of God, the desire for beauty. Another aspect to decorative art is that it fades into the background. This is not a bad thing. When you go into a house, you're not immediately drawn to that piece of cloth over there. It's just part of the entire room that you're in. It adds to the beauty of it, but it's not designed for you to look at it, except in certain instances. Primarily, it's meant to fade into the background and provide sort of the environment that you're in. But it does communicate a philosophy or an attitude towards life, and that's very much the point, one of the points that she's making in this book. Edith Schaefer talks about some African teenagers, children who were not very impressed with some missionaries' perspective, because when they would go into the missionary's house, there was no beauty. They said, you know, what good is this that you're saying if there's nothing beautiful about it? These poor Africans who had not very much money focused a lot more on surrounding themselves with beauty, beautiful things. And the American missionaries had just lived purely functionally. There was no touch of, you know, whatever decoration. I'm no good at actually decorating, so I can't speak in those terms. But it really did affect their perspective of their view of what the missionaries were saying. And they were just frankly not impressed. And on the other hand, I know she didn't really say this directly, but when she was in Le Brie in Switzerland, the fact that she did have a desire for beauty, surrounding herself with beauty, brought in a lot of people that wouldn't normally have come into a Christian environment. It was it goes on both sides. I think that the gospel is inherently beautiful, and so we should live in the light of the gospel. Okay, fine art. This is what we always think of when we think of art. And so, going back to art as work, it's very important that we cover functional art and decorative art because of wanting to understand art as work. However, by nature, functional art and decorative art are not very complex. They're not meant to be pondered. They're not meant to be discussed at length. And so there's really not that much to say about them, except in terms of ideas that you can do, and that's where this book comes in very handy. Fine art is made for its aesthetic meaning alone. It is not meant to be used for something. If you have a quilt and it's on your bed, it's a piece of functional art. The minute you take your quilt and hang it up on the wall, it becomes fine art. It's not warming anybody. It's not comforting anybody. Now, quilters will know that you make some quilts in a certain way for a bed and some quilts in a certain way for the wall. And so, of course, there's a difference in how you go about making this art. Painting, sculpture, music, drama, literature, all kinds of things would be classified as fine art. And they demand and they deserve attention. When you walk into a room, an art gallery with a painting, there's a sufficient space between it and the next painting so that you can focus on that painting. When someone is reading a poem, it's not background noise. When you're listening to a symphony, hopefully it's not background noise. Especially if you're in a live symphony, it's the forefront thing. It should be filling your senses. You should feel the double basses in the floor, and you should hear the all the instruments throughout. You should be fully immersed in it. That's one of the natures of fine art. So that is a quick overview of the different kinds of art, the scope of art. Before I go on, please feel free to interrupt with questions or examples. If anything strikes your fancy, please talk about it.
Just a question. There would be a very little difference between decorative art and fine arts then. Like a decorative art object would be decorative and it could be fine arts as well.
Correct. The main distinction would be whether you are supposed to be looking at it and paying attention to it or not. If you walk into somebody's house and like the vase they have, it might be purely decorative, but you might be very pleased by it and it might strike your fancy. You might notice it. But it was not made necessarily for aesthetic meaning. It was made for aesthetic value. Fine art often says something. Perhaps not in explicit words, and usually, if it does so in explicit words, it's doing its job poorly. So that's probably. But as I said, it's a very blurry distinction. Yes.
Why do you say that the Christian worldview fosters either the creation of art or the appreciation of art? Why do you say that?
The reason I say that, and we'll get into this a little bit more later. Other worldviews don't account for meaning. correctly. So, for instance, the majority worldview in American culture today is physicalist materialism, the idea that all there is matter. If you say all there is matter, you are very hard-pressed to say that there is meaning to anything. There is no meaning.
Because I'm thinking of other religions.
Okay, other religions?
The Mayan culture, the Egyptian culture, all these things that created so much, that did not have a Christian worldview.
Okay, well, they have a lot easier time because they are a lot closer to truth. The primary problem is that they're wrong, right? So if you look at Mayan culture, they have aspects of truth, that there are deities, that there is a spiritual realm, and therefore there is meaning, but they're wrong about their spiritual realm. And so that leads to other aspects. Less so in... I'll go ahead and talk about it. The form and content distinction. A piece of art will have form, how it's done, and content, what's done. With other religions, with pagan religions, you'll get bad content rather than bad form, oftentimes. And so that's... Does that help at all?
A little bit. But okay. They're beautiful.
Certainly. Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely, they are beautiful. And okay, so stepping back, I'm not saying that... Christianity is the only worldview that produces beautiful things. They're the only worldview that can say we have a reason for... We are allowed to say that beauty exists. We are right in saying that beauty exists.
We know the reason. We know the reason it exists. Other people do it mostly out of the image of God. It's there, and they have no reason. And their worldview is totally against it.
Right. And so when the Mayan makes something beautiful, he's doing so kind of in spite of being anti-God.
Right.
But philosophically, he's allowed to say it because he can say there is meaning, there is beauty, that kind of thing. Jeff?
I was going to say, you were talking about computer programming being functional, you could make it beautiful. I would think that something really highly functional and efficient, and you know, as it works and as you use it, can be considered an art in itself, just even though the person that went and designed it probably really wasn't thinking in an artistic way, just more of a functional way, trying to get it perfectly to work.
That's true. Beautiful things can come by accident. But I guess my desire in saying that art as work is sort of saying this is what your intention should be, rather than something that is efficient can also be beautiful as a side effect. That's kind of the nature of the orderliness of God and orderliness of creation and the orderliness of man's mind as a result of being an image bearer of God. So, and Chris?
Oh, I was just going to, it's a real, real short point. It was sort of in conjunction with what Mike just said. Christians recognize the true source.
Right.
All beauty,
right.
Truth, and that's the key.
Right, and as a result, we are more able, more equipped, even though it doesn't look like it in modern day Christianity. We are more equipped to produce beautiful things because the art that we produce is beautiful, can be beautiful in both content and form, because the content, if we're retelling the story of the gospel, the resurrection. It is the most beautiful thing in the world, especially for a human. If we're retelling the story of creation, we look at a tree and glory in its complexity and its simplicity, then we're better equipped to do that because we have a proper understanding of the nature of creation, the nature of man, fallen nature of man. When we look at a painting like Guernica by Picasso and we see the torment of war and the horrors of war, we can understand this is a result of the fall. But there's a happy ending to this story. There's the gospel. So I keep shooting in different directions at your question, but I don't know if it's helpful. Pat?
No, I think one thing that we as Christians don't want to ever appear to be short-sighted, and that may be part of your concern, that there are cultures that are entirely pagan that produce very beautiful things. And so we want to be careful, I think, that we don't just throw stuff out that is legitimately beautiful or what have you and try to make a case that this pagan culture can't produce anything beautiful because they don't understand Christianity, and that we could get into some difficult waters there. But I think that your point is that anything that's non-Christian is non-Christian for various reasons, and there are a thousand worldviews out here, and some are more consistent to Christianity than others, and so some that are way off, the variance is stronger and it's easier to differentiate. Others that are other worldviews have various things that are somewhat consistent with what we believe, and as those cultures in or worldviews improve, i.e., they get closer to what we actually believe, then there may be more overlap. But the core is still wrong. So it is still the same wrongness as the culture that or worldview that seems radically different. But for the production of beauty or something like that, there may be some overlap. And we want to be able to commend what we can, but then also qualify that with, the reality is those worldviews that are more consistent with Christianity are the ones that are the most concerning, because they're more deceptive.
That's true.
They're equally as damning. So.
And Chris?
And also, because we are all, even in a fallen world, we're fallen, but we're the image bearers of God, albeit fallen, and God has given all human beings, a spark of the creativity and that drives the production of beautiful things. And they may not recognize where that came from, but they still have it, and they're capable.
Absolutely. So, as we come into the next part of the discussion, form and content, I do want to say first and foremost, well, as sort of a tying up the previous thing and introducing the next, we ought not to throw out something because it's not Christian. There is a lot of truth that man still retains. Man is trying to suppress the truth in unrighteousness, as Romans 1 says. But throwing something out because it's not Christian is often very foolish. Yes, Shelley?
Well, when you say because it's not Christian, what does that mean? Because it's
not done by a Christian. Not done by a Christian, I think.
Not done by a Christian? Okay.
So that there are many people who seem to only accept things if they are done by Christians. They are explicitly, speaking of art, done by Christians in explicitly Christian content, and really the quality of it doesn't matter.
And what you were saying earlier ties into that, because what's happened to the quality of so-called Christian art? It seems like people think it has to be Christian subject matter, done by a Christian, etc.
Right.
That takes away so much from the concept that everything is God's creation and that everything beautiful is really ultimately from Him.
Right. The modern-day Christianity has a very sharp divide between life and church. You can be religious in your life, but in terms of religion affecting and touching every aspect of our being, they don't really think in that way. And that's one of our desires in this course, is to fight that, because every one of us has grown up in that culture, I would say. Probably, I don't know about the Dominican Republic culture, but some more than others, especially, I don't know. I grew up in the South, so that's all I know, but we as American Christians are fighting the notion that our life is somehow split in two. There is a secular and there is a sacred, and somehow there is a distinction between the two. God commands and deserves all of our life, not just Sunday, we know that, not just Wednesday night, we know that, but not just religious topics either. When we are eating cereal, when we are mowing the lawn, when we are writing a paper, we do it all to the glory of God. And that is fundamentally for a Christian what art is. It's doing all to the glory of God and doing it well, aesthetically well. So next, we're going to talk about form and content. Form being how it's done and content what's being done. Every piece of art has form. Every piece of art has content. Fine art. And other kinds of art as well. I'm not going to say that they don't, but when you are a piece of fine art your desire is to say something oftentimes, and that would be the content. Yes, Dana?
Quick question. Is part of the reason why perhaps Christians have not always done so well at, you know, kind of the problems that you're pointing out, is because we, some aspects of Christianity are that, you know, we're in a war, and warfare is very, art becomes a luxury. And so, like, for example, the missionaries, you know, they're trying to survive in Africa and reach these peoples. They don't have as much resource and time to spend on, you know, the things that we might think of as important in a certain context, but in another context they may be extravagant and not necessary. And so Christians who maybe are focused more on the absolutely critical things can lose sight of, and so we need some balance, I guess, but there's always going to be that tension of we've got to stick with what's really important. And art is one of those things that we tend to think of maybe as a luxury that we can go without sometimes.
As I wonder...
You know, I don't know where the breaking point is, but it seems like that might be part of why we tend to fail in that.
I think that's probably true. What I wonder is if that doesn't belie a misunderstanding of the conflict.
Yes.
If we understand that it's a spiritual warfare, and that art very much, if art helps us to understand God better, if art understands to, helps us to understand His creation better, helps us to understand the plight of man and the way man gets out of the plight, I would almost say it's a weapon and a defense.
I think it also draws us near to God. Just when we see a beautiful thing, like I experienced that as a musician playing in an orchestra, playing secular music, maybe not, you know, Beethoven wasn't Christian, I don't believe, whatever. You can have this wonderful spiritual experience drawing near to God through art.
I agree. And
it strengthens your spirit.
Yes. Yes, it does. I'm going all over my notes here, but I don't mind. There are ways in which art communicates that cannot be communicated by word. That is not to say that God spoke to us explicitly primarily through words. But that's not all there is. That's not all there is to God. The orderliness of creation is a testimony to His creative ability. When an artist orders nature, orders sound in a particular way that is pleasing, exhilarating, enjoyable, fun, it glorifies God. And I think as an artist, in fact, and this is perhaps a reason why people should learn something. Learn to recite poetry, learn to sing, learn to play music. This is so that you can participate in the order of God's creation in art.
Jepson. I was going to say that I think it would help us to be a better witness to people, especially artisans on the outside, that, you know, if we were to hone the image that we have of God and try to produce art that's more and more beautiful, more and more highly respected on the outside, so that, you know, they don't see us as some anti-intellectual,
anti-art, anti-aesthetics.
Yeah. We produce these little simple images and kind of crude art of sorts, you know, and they're out there creating beautiful things that they don't look at us as being desirable. Mm-hmm. But I think we need to be, as Christians, even better than they are in some ways, and especially in art, I think.
I think, I mean, you know, if there's anything that epitomized the war between, you know, humanity and sin, it was the sacrificial system in the temple. And yet, even in all of that, you have this glorious building that God says was a, you know, later on He says that it was a picture of heaven itself. You know, cherubim and palm trees and pomegranates inscribed around the wall, the beauty and the ornateness of the veil that separated the holy from the most holy place, this massive, you know, during the time of Solomon, this massive choir of skilled singers and musicians offering up God's praises. I mean, there, and even the priestly garment was just beautiful, you know. And you really see that God is really concerned about the beautiful, even at the place where, you know, the slaying of lambs is a constant reminder of our sin and the wretchedness of our condition.
Right. What better? And this comes down, this is one of the reasons I so love the incarnation, the very idea that God would come down and take human flesh. He can tell us, I'll save you. He can tell us, I can relate to your hard life. Or he can send down his Son in the very flesh, something we can see and taste and hear and touch. When we're taking communion, we're interacting with our senses, our sense of smell and sight and touch and taste. This is God interacting with us on a level that we can really understand. We may be able to have some complex thought in our head, but you know, how many good theologians are there who are utter pagans, right? And if we think in terms of art for the various acts of God in His providence and in His creation, how much more glorious is it when we take communion and we can interact with our senses? Was it we next? There were several hands. Okay, so Sam.
I just think it's encouraging, sort of along the point that you made about Christians being able to account for art, because we know that God created. We can look at the creation and see, you know, He did not create in black and white. He adorned the creation with beauty, flowers. He used colors to make things aesthetically pleasing. He created man to be able to appreciate those things. He makes birds sing. He's given man the ability to intonate his voice and sing. And all these things are harmonized by our understanding of the world that other religions have a hard time accounting for, because they've lost elements of the truth, to be able to harmonize everything like Christianity can. Christianity can harmonize this world and man's appreciation and use of it because of our understanding of truth, because God has deposited the truth in the Scriptures and we can appreciate that. We can see how God has made all these things, and as the image of God, we can do similar things by using music, by using art, and color, and all of, and form, you know, when the way that God has used form in the world, it's functional, and yet it's beautiful. And we do similar things.
Is that how you would define what beauty is by looking at creation, or how do you define beauty from a biblical point of view?
I'm not going to try.
I mean, certainly there's
a... who was it?
Wendy.
Who was it said, truth is beauty, beauty is truth, and that's all we need to know? I would say creation is beautiful, God is beautiful. I would say the best way to understand what beauty is to experience it. I can't define it at all.
There are some things that people, in fact, when I talk about images of spiritual things, I'll get a little bit into this. Jonathan Edwards has done some good writing about the nature of beauty and especially how it correlates to the beauty of God. And he's written an essay that you can download from the internet called The Nature of True Virtue. And that is one that you could look at, where he talks a little bit about the idea of aesthetics, and then especially how it relates to God, who is the supremely beautiful being. But it's very difficult to define in, you know, in perfect detail what beauty is. And I really like what Jimmy said. Sometimes it's just experience it. But that does not mean that beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Right.
And Jimmy would never say that. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, God. God is the one who standardizes beauty. But He hasn't necessarily given us all the definitions and parameters of what exactly beauty is. But there are some things I think we can say that's
certainly
not beautiful and this is beautiful.
There are objective aspects to beauty and there are subjective aspects to beauty. This kind of one of the points I wanted to make was to talk about taste. What is taste? Discerning between the difference between the likable and the good. If something is good, then it is beautiful, but we might not like it. But taste is learning to appreciate what is good. Now, yes, that's a can of worms. Mm-hmm. What is good? You know, you say that to an atheist. it's completely relative as far as he's concerned. For us, yeah, there are relative aspects to it, but there are very much objective aspects to beauty.
Examples?
Objective?
Examples of both, yeah.
Orderly, pleasing. Now, I'm not going to say pretty. I'm not going to say positive. I'm not going to say sweet. I'm not going to say happy. But if it corresponds to truth, I'm not going to say much more. But yes, it has to do with truth and it has to do with morality. If someone is portraying immorality as good, it can be done well, but that is not a good piece of art. Pornography is an example of bad art that is so immoral that it cannot have good aesthetics. It just cannot. Objectively, it is not beautiful, so perhaps it's easier to say what's not. But
yes, well, even Mike. The meaning of it. When I was in Israel, there was on one of the kibbutzes, which is a farming community there, there was a guy who was an incredible metal worker, and he could create all kinds of statues and whatnot out of metal. But when we were walking through, the guy that was our leader pointed to one particular piece of art, and NC State fan would have loved it because it looked like a big red hand. You know, we're number one.
But the purpose
of that piece of art was it was the red symbolized the blood of all the Jews that died in the Holocaust, and the finger was pointing to heaven, blaming God that it was God's fault. So you look at it, and it was beautifully done, but in essence, it was an ugly piece of artwork because of the purpose for which it was created and why it was created, the message exactly.
Yeah.
And like you were saying before, you know, art, fine art has a message, and you don't always know that message, but this one was well known.
So here we have a piece of art where the content overwhelms the quality of the beauty, of the form. Can we think of any examples of content that's not so great, but the form is really good and it's worth understanding?
Music, for example.
Mm-hmm. What? The work of a child.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you look at some of the pictures that your children draw and it's like, can you tell me what this is?
Jackson Pollock.
But when they tell you what it is and what they have tried to convey in that picture, and you see their mind at work and what they're really trying to convey, and sometimes when they start to explain it, you can see through things, and they give it to you in love, and it's a beautiful piece of art.
So that's almost a different dimension altogether. I would just say that is, I don't know, maybe ability. Because there's, when I'm saying form, and I think when Mr. Veith is saying form, I think he's saying given someone who can do something well, or given someone who is at a mature level. When I would think, if I were to think of good content, bad form, I would think of a lot of Christian music. Very good content. Poetry is okay. Music's okay. It's not going to last. It can be encouraging, it can be uplifting, but you would hardly say that the form was anything special. I would say that a child, maybe that speaks more to potential than form or anything like that, but certainly the content is there.
We were listening recently to some John Piper, a series on worship, and he was kind of going through the struggle that his church went through in terms of what form of music to use in, you know, traditional versus contemporary, whatever. But he made a very strong distinction, mainly to talking about music, but you could kind of stretch it out to other forms as well. But he was talking about fine versus folk music, and, you know, folk art versus fine art, and explaining that the folk art is like the contemporary, you know, the, maybe the music you're talking about, good content, but simple, little rhymes are simple, whatever, and then you have the fine music that maybe, you know, Handel's Messiah or some other form of classical music. But he said, in a sense, it mirrors the Great Commission. The Great Commission is to go out to all. Folk music is easily understood by all, and it can go across a variety of cultures with not... You may not would want to go play Handel's Messiah in an African village and, you know, try to explain to someone who has never had any discipline of listening closely to a...
Western harmony.
Yeah, or whatever. But and then he was like, sort of what you just said about, you know, it won't last. Something may be good in its art form, fine art, but it's not popular. Whereas something may be very popular, but not good. So the classic, it would be always what is truly good. And then furthermore than that, like, for instance, some of the post-millennialists would... And their conquering of the world, in a sense, they would say, you know, the best composer in the world should be a Christian. The best sculptor should be a Christian. We own, in a sense, music. We own, our art was made for us, in the sense that Christians are the, you know, the light of the world. And, I mean, the salt of whatever. It's just we're supposed to be the best in terms of expressing God's.
Right. Not to open another can of worms, but I would say that you don't have to take over the world to do everything with all your might as unto the Lord. Yeah. Take over the world is... anyway. So we have good form, good content, bad form, good content, bad form, bad content, pornography. Good form, good content. That is... There's a lot of non-Christian art that has good form and good content. Now, it may not be perfect content, so of course that is a sliding scale, you might say. But the best content would be Christian. The best form ought to be Christian. It often isn't. So, this comes back to art as work. If we think in terms of art in everyday life, if we understand the verse, do all... unto the Lord, as unto the Lord, then if we think of that in terms of art, then I think our lives would be better. I think we would do better at things. We would produce better art. We would be more inclined to encourage our children to produce art. Veith, in his book, talks about the awkwardness that an artist has when he says to a Christian, I'm an artist. If he's a Christian, if the artist is a Christian, he says, the Christian says in his mind, somehow this is an invalid vocation. There's something weird about it, and I think that awkwardness needs to go away. I think we ought to have people who are vocationally artists. That's not to say the best artists will necessarily be primarily artists. T.S. Eliot, who became a Christian later in his life, really a great poet and a great understander of poetry, was a banker. So, you know, it's not to say that we can't produce fine art. It's a matter of priority. If we look at our lives in terms of producing things for God to delight in as for us as his children... The image of father and child is such an amazing one because, like Mike was saying, your child can give you a work of art and you delight in it. It may be a feeble attempt at the craft. You may say, well, your spacing's kind of weird and the use of color is a bit overdone or whatever. You don't do that. God doesn't look at our art that we produce for him and in those terms. So this class very much ties into what Scott's going to go into in a few weeks, so I don't want to tread too much on his toes, but the father-the parent-child relationship is a very large image of God, of spiritual things that God has placed in our lives. And it's something that really is a very wonderful thing to experience in terms of understanding the way that God has God relates to us. If I were a poet, I would probably have written a poem that would have said all this in a much better way. But hopefully, we're learning. So form and content, we should aim to have both good form and good content. We should aim to understand and to distinguish between form and content. If we look at a work of art and it's saying something that's utterly ridiculous in terms of reality, but it does so in a beautiful way, we should be able to appreciate the beauty of it. We should be able to say, this is beautiful. But, I mean, they say, they're saying something that I don't agree with, but it's still a very beautiful thing.
Can we still junk it?
Junk it?
Joke it.
Joke it?
Yeah.
Sure. Why not?
Because this client, this today is about our appreciation for art, which, in sense, and there's a lot of us walking around that may not have as, well, there's some of us walking around like me that may not have a strong appreciation for art. And when I am going into a corporate office and there's this big fountain and there's a rock and a stick and there's a plaque this sculpture represents common man struggling against a capitalistic society or something, and I'm for capitalism. I'm really joking that.
Let me address that.
So that kind of stuff dovetails somewhat into, and I know that Sam and I want to have the freedom to joke those kind of things.
Please joke it.
Dana.
Please make fun of it. That is not good form.
But this has been a little bit on a serious note convicting to me that I have certainly not thought about these relationships nearly enough. But I would tend to denigrate. And I would think I'd probably be accurate in that. But that's another discussion.
I would say it's probably, in a lot of cases, it would be accurate to make fun of it.
Okay.
And we might talk about it later. But basically, the modern art world looks at itself in a very high light. This goes, again, back to art as work. Art is for the common man. Now, fine art might be hard to understand for the common man, but I dare say that there are many pieces of classical music that a normal guy, if he just sits down and listens to it, without getting all hung up about, oh, this is art, this is fancy, or whatever, he would think it's beautiful, if he allows himself to think that something is beautiful. If you have a rock and a stick, and you have to explain what it is, the art's not doing a very good job, right? When you start having to explain, on one hand, when art is purely didactic and says, here's a painting, and it depicts a boy, you know, disobeying his mother and getting his head chopped off, that's didactic, and it does a very poor job at communicating anything. The boy's just going to think, oh, that's a funny picture, and not learn anything. But if you produce a work of art that somehow really does take your heart, twist it a little bit, and say, this is the consequence of sin, that's when art really starts succeeding. And a rock and a stick and a fountain may be aesthetically pleasing, but if they have to explain it as... I would say that is bad form.
You're saying even from a technical standpoint, the fact that the virtue of the plaque demonstrates that this is poor art because it's really having to describe what is going on, and if that's taking place, then that betrays the weakness of the juxtaposition of the rock and the stick, basically. Come on.
And so this gets into...
But he talked about Picasso's Horse of War. Would you know what that was about?
Yes.
Knowing the title of the picture?
Oh, yeah. Looking at that painting, I don't know if you've ever seen it.
I'm not sure if I'm thinking about it.
It's about the size of this board. You look at that painting and you see pain, right? You see cubist pain, but it's pain nonetheless. You see people crying out, you see animals involved, and you see all kinds of things. There might be things that are fundamentally wrong with abstract art, but they're still working with God, what God has. If they are still taking what God made and arranging it in a certain way to say something, it's still art. And I think Picasso is not necessarily the worst of the lot. There's a lot in modernism that's bad, silly, ridiculous, but there's a lot that's good. They, in terms of the form, Picasso was still an artist exerting dominion over color, over proportion and shape and lighting. I like that painting, but... Are you, is it Chris?
You know, you mentioned the word taste before, and that really plays a big part. And I have a taste for more realistic art rather than abstract, perhaps, which then affects how much I appreciate what I'm looking at. Mm. And my own personal experience I bring to it, too. And appreciating any form of art is very subjective. And, you know, I mean, I've read and been asked to analyze a piece of poetry that I couldn't understand. And yet it might be, you know, a very famous and very good piece of poetry, at least in the eyes of the professor. You know, but, I mean, it's just, it's a very subjective thing.
So this is where... my comment earlier about understanding the form comes in. There is good art that is very difficult. There is bad art that is very difficult. There is art that is difficult for the sake of being difficult because they're writing poems to other poets, not to common man. And this is sort of the inbred nature of the modern art world. The current president of the National, I think it's Education Association, is a poet, a neo-formalist. He likes to rhyme. He likes to use meter. He likes to have structure to his poetry to work within. His opinion is that people should stop analyzing poetry so much and start memorizing it. Because if you're analyzing poetry, you're sucking all the life out of it. If you're analyzing art, you're sucking the life out of it. Now, that's not to say you should understand what makes a poem good, what makes a piece of art good. This is what we have to develop, and I think as Christians we have a lot of room to grow or regrow. But discernment is different from destruction by analysis, taking something apart to see what makes it work, and in the process destroying it. We're out of time, and I got halfway through the second of 5 pages. So, next week I was going to talk about mathematics, the Christian view of mathematics. It's a subject that is near and dear to my heart, but perhaps not to most people. I would like to cover a little bit, but I think we'll continue this next week.
That sounds better than math.
I'm not surprised. But okay, well, let's pray. Father, we thank you for making us human. We thank you for fashioning us after your image, giving us reason, giving us an appreciation for beauty, a desire for beauty, an ability to create beauty, to subcreate beauty, to imitate you in our creative acts. We thank you for setting such a beautiful example in creation, in your providence, the symphony of working all things together for the good of those who love you and are called according to your purpose. We thank you for the beauty of the story of redemption, the amazing way in which you worked it out, the way you prepared the way, the culmination of the sacrifice on the cross and the resurrection. We pray that you would help us to develop, help us as believers to develop our artistic sensibilities, our ability to discern between good and bad form and content. We pray that you would give us a desire, perhaps not fervent desire at first, but we pray that you would increase our love for the arts, especially those arts which glorify you and tell your good things. We pray that you would bless us now, prepare us for worship, help us to delight in the music that your saints have created. It's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.